we can begin. Today is Monday morning, April 27th, 2015. And as I said yesterday, the sun is not so strong. The flowers are not so colorful. The air is not so light. Reb Aaron is gone. It's a different world. It's a different world. But the Lebedicker Daffen Gain Weiter. We have no choice. Tonight, everyone knows that at 8 o'clock we're davening Marafir, and then we're having a hespedim or eulogies, or call it what you wish. I would call my talk more a musishmuis, and based upon Reb Aaron, and it's in English. A lot of calls came in to Gris if people were thwarted because everything else was in Hebrew, and as you know, Americans growing up in Art Scroll are not exactly masters of modern Hebrew, and even if you live in Beit Shemesh, it doesn't mean you'll be a master of modern Hebrew. So tonight here it's in English. Last night at the Gush it was in English. I understand that Julie Berman spoke, which did anyone hear? It must be online, I trust. Julie should be very interesting because no one was closer to Reb Aaron in the last 40, 50 years than Julie Berman. They're older than I am. When I came into yeshiva, I knew Aaron right away because that was, anyone involved in real learning knew Reb Aaron right away. And Julie, I also know, Julie's like somewhere between us. I would imagine Julie is two to three years younger than Reb Aaron. And Julie's an interesting individual. His father was a shochet, what was it, New Haven? Hartford, Young Israel, very close to Reb Moshe Feinstein. Reb Moshe used to come there, run away from the city during the summer. Yeah, it was a great world. And Midafkin Vaita. And in Beit Shemesh, I'm happy to say, you have a part of the Lichtenstein heritage. You have Reb Meir Lichtenstein there, the Lichtenstein boys, I have a special relationship with, because I remember them when they were just the gleam in their parents' eyes. Okay, let's come back to the Rebbe. And I got a lot of compliments from those who know what Lubavitch is going through. And when you read the literature, there's so much criticism. Why, they come up with, they intimate to you some mysterious theory. Why from 1923 to 1928 they were engaged 5 years. Who heard of being engaged 5 years? Then such an ostentatious wedding. And people have to understand the period. It was a very tragic period where the seventh Rebbe's parents can't come to his wedding. Now you think for yourself, when you raise a son who's the apple of your eye, when you raise a son who's so unique and you can't go to his wedding. And they were cut off. It was a terrible situation. During these years, the sixth Rebbe himself suffered something horrendously with the communists running away and having to reestablish himself in Riga, raising funds to support the Jews behind the Iron Curtain, and finally the big moment came for their marriage. Now, two comments. One, a student listening, R.A.K., and this I didn't mention, but I also know the tradition in Chabad is that the Shidduch was first thought of by the fifth Rebbe, by Reb Shalom Be'er, by the Rashab. And here, there are two traditions. Who did he talk with? Did he talk with his wife, Revitzin Shternesara, or did he talk with the Riatz, with his son, the sixth Rebbe? But we should think about the eldest son of Rev Livik, that's Rev Levi Yitzchak, the seventh Rebbe's father, for our granddaughter, Chaya Mushka. If you ask me, I would imagine he spoke with his wife, and the wife already spoke with her son, the Riatz, and put the Shidduch into motion. Generally speaking, when it comes to Yoni Shidduch, you have to talk with a woman, not with a man. That's what life has taught me. But I just want to make that comment. Now, in relation to Rabbi Rubin, and I just need a minute to try to call him. I'm just a terrible week of here, there, and everywhere. But his comment about Tanya says that the neshama of a guy is different than the neshama of a Jew, he caused a lot of commotion among Chabadnikim listening. And I'll give him two of the emails that arrived. But both emails make one comment that is interesting. The Gemara, when the Gemara speaks about conversion, the Gemara uses the expression ger shenit gayer. A ger, a convert who converted. Really, if you want to speak proper Hebrew, it should be goy shenit gayer. A Gentile converted. So you see from this that a ger shenit gayer already has a special neshama to begin with. His neshama was also at Har Sinai. And there's a lot of truth to it. As I've said time and again, I have come across converts all over. And inevitably, Yitzchak, I'm talking about you right now. Why are you late? Not fair. Inevitably, when people convert, I always ask them, do you have any Jewish forebears? And many times you'll see that there was a great-grandfather, a great-grandmother, a nusim, and you see, that's what Chabad is saying. Ger shenit gayer, not goy shenit gayer. All right, be it as it may, there are other explanations here too, and at the end of the class I'll give it to Rabbi Rubin, and he can correspond with the people who are writing to him. All right, now, last week we spoke about the Ufruf, the Shidduch, the years, and finally we come to the wedding. Now, the wedding has been written up by many sources, Hebrew, English, Yiddish, all the books coming out on the Rebbe. And basically here we have no conflict, we don't have to do much research, we have actual records, people who were there, memoirs, and we can recreate the entire picture. One has to be a chassid to appreciate the wedding, to appreciate everything that happened. We spoke last week about the Rebbe, about the invitations, and as we mentioned, there were three levels, and Ein Hachinami until today, if you're familiar with Hasidic lore and legend, when the Belz Rebbe, the Gerer Rebbe, or the Vishnus Rebbe make a simcha to the other Rebbeim who they honor, they will send a not just a printed invitation, but a handwritten invitation. It's a concept here of kavod, that a printed invitation, you know, it's 60,000 people at Yankee Stadium, big deal. 60,000 invitations, Yehuda V'yod. But if you go out of the way to write by hand and write to the Rebbe, here you have to visit the Rebbe and present it in person and invite him. And you see the sixth Rebbe activated the invitations on three different levels. The masses, the Tomchei Tumimin, the students, and I explained to you he was in charge of the yeshiva, so that these students meant a great deal to him. And finally, the Elter Chassidim, Rebbeim, the people, the royalty, for them it was handwritten, signature of the Rebbe, etc. And I told you, you don't need a better example. Sitting here in the classroom is someone who bid on an invitation to the Rav's wedding, a plain, simple, printed invitation. And believe me, it cost Jay Solomon more money to buy that invitation than it originally cost to print all the invitations in Vilna and indexing the cost. Do you follow me, Jay? To say that you spent more money than Vilna is no chiddush, but indexing it, you still came out paying more. So if Jay Solomon felt that way about invitation to the Rav's wedding, and he's a Talmud, he's not a chassid, Allah kama v'kama, what a chassid feels about it ever. Okay, And then the Ufrif we spoke about in Riga, we ended off the class, and again the question of all the Jews behind the Iron Curtain who couldn't come to the wedding, how much that hurt the sixth Rebbe, how much it hurt the seventh Rebbe, his own parents couldn't come. All right, then they get on the train from Riga. Mob scenes. Remember, Riga was an Irva Ein B'Yisrael. Riga had, the Rebbe was there, thousands of chassidim, and with great joy they get on the train. The wealthier chassidim who could afford the train ticket and put up for lodgings in Warsaw went along with the Rebbe, and 7 a.m. Monday morning they arrive in Warsaw. Hundreds of chassidim, tamimim from the yeshiva, chassidim of other rabbeim. Warsaw was a merkaz, a moked, a center, a hotbed of chassidim. Everyone is there to greet the Rebbe. Now, when I say the Rebbe, more the sixth Rebbe than the seventh Rebbe. The sixth Rebbe, then Riatz was in his prime. The son-in-law, not many people knew who he was. They know of him. They heard rumors. I would imagine even Hasidim can be a little bit skeptical. And they heard these rumors, you know, a Gaon Adir, he knows Kala Torah Kula, Nigla Venista. I imagine some of them were quixotic about it. But the sixth Rebbe was greeted, and the seventh Rebbe runs away, runs to the hotel, runs to where he's staying with Rebbe Leo Chaim Altos. Now, Rebbe Leo Chaim is his shomer. This is the person who remains with the Rebbe, and a good deal of what we know about the Rebbe and the wedding is because of his shomer, Leo Chaim, who later writes a memoir, word by word, what happened while the wedding takes place. Monday night, and here too, it's interesting, Chassidim have a custom. You see, it's amazing to see the difference between the non-Jewish world and the Jewish world. When we, Gramin, Purim, it's a world gone by, the world in which I grew up, Yitzchak grew up, Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein grew up, a world gone by. So Purim, we used to sing Gramin in the yeshiva. And among the Gramin, they used to sing Masha, who can something like this. Veil is ayid, it's good for a Jew. Davening muza, he has to daven. And a guy daf trinken, they were contrasting the Jew and the guy. So Reb David Lifshitz, the Tzuvalka Rav, got up and he would exclaim, name, in tongue and sing it, you can't sing the grammar like this. A Jew is wonderful. Daven in Vilar. He wants to daven. You follow me, Jason? Not that he must daven. And he would make us re-sing it. We, you know, Purim, everyone was happy to do what Rav David wanted us to do. Davening Vilha. So now you look at a guy. The night before the wedding, they have stag parties. I don't want to describe to you what these parties are. There was a terrible case in Israel. Some of you are aware of it. I mean, if you live here and know the news, I think he just got out of jail. That he was one of the top bodyguards of Rabin and of the prime minister. And the night before his wedding, or whenever the stag party was, if I'm using the right term, stag. I got scared that that's a siren. Stag, S-T-A-G. Am I using the right term? Okay, Baruch Hashem. I mean, I'm not exactly an expert in this, but he raped a woman the night before. He was dead drunk. He went to jail. They just paroled him. And amazingly, it's also in the non-Jewish world, they think differently. These are Jews that don't have Torah and have only Western civilization. The woman that he was engaged to actually married him when he got out of jail now. It was in the newspapers a few weeks ago, months ago already, perhaps. So you see, the goyim before the wedding, a stag party. I don't want to describe to you what the tradition is among the non-Jewish world. The Jewish world, the particularly you take the great Rebbeim, they had traditions. You have it until today. They make a suda, I believe in Vishnus, before there's a wedding, for all the poor people in Bnei Brak. They make a suda. It's a beautiful, beautiful thought. What a difference between us, those who have Torah and those who don't have Torah. I met a kid on Shabbos, a friend of one of my grandsons. He was over for Shabbos, stayed at my daughter's home. So I met him at Shabbos lunch, Mincha. A kid from the Ukraine whose family wanders to Australia. Chabad picks them up in Australia. This young man, he's in dental school today. He did Army, Nachal Haredi, I gather. Was in Alon Shvut, studied in Alon Shvut. That's where this grandson knows him from. From Alon Shvut, from Har Etzion. And you see a human being, Ashrei Ayin Rat Hazot. I told my grandson, only bring me friends like this young man you brought today. So this is what Jews do before the wedding. What did the Rebbe do? The Rebbe sent a telegram to Warsaw that he wants them to arrange a suda before the wedding for the Talmidim of Tomchei Tamimim. See, this was the Rebbe's greatest feeling, greatest achievement. There's a tomorrow. There's a yeshiva. This is very important. As far as I understand, they were the first to organize the yeshiva. Later, Ger organizes the yeshiva, Sfat Emet. I would imagine Belz has a yeshiva today. But a yeshiva was unheard of in the Hasidic world. Hasidic world, you ganyan bam Rebbe, from Rebbe's Hof, you went with the Rebbe's court, and you learned. There was a Beit Medrash, there were young people learning, there were Elter Rabbanim who helped you with a difficult Gemara, but this was a yeshiva, a real organized yeshiva. And the night before, Monday evening, there was a tremendous Sudat Mitzvah in honor of the Chatan. And we're talking 1928. We're talking the wedding was, what did you say? Kislev Yudalev. So this is the night before. Although Monday night already, then it depends what they consider Tuesday. Because Tuesday, you have to look at a calendar, because the wedding might have been after sunset, before sunset on Tuesday. But this is Monday evening at 8 p.m., so it has to be already Yudalev. And at this dinner, the Rebbe said Divrei Torah, and the Rebbe danced with all the students from Tomchei Tamimim. When I say the Rebbe, I mean the sixth Rebbe. I mean the Riatz. The meal ended with great festivity at 2 a.m. in the morning. So you can understand Chassidim also. They don't sleep. That's also amazing. If you're a chassid, you just think for a minute, Friday night, you go home, you make kiddush, you eat, you bench, you head to the Rebbe for a tish. When do you get to sleep? 2 in the morning, 2:30 in the morning. It's an amazing thing. Lubavitch, of course, was in 7th Rebbe, was much more modernized, I would say. The Rebbe would hold the Fabrengen Shabbos afternoon. And by Chabad, what the Shraim amounted to was the lekach that they gave out and the vodka. And you would drink a lechayim to the Rebbe. In other words, you didn't drink until the Rebbe acknowledged your lechayim. And if you ever saw a Fabrengen, you would hold up your kos, and the Rebbe would look. They're movies. You don't have to believe me. I mean, I was there in person. I saw the Rebbe would look in there. So 1,000 chassidim within this eye range would swear the Rebbe's looking right at them. Then the Rebbe would look a little bit. Again, lechayim, lechayim, lechayim shalom tam. L'chaim, 1,000. So the minute the Rebbe looked in your direction and said l'chaim, you drank. But chassidim, what a world, what a life. Okay, Tuesday, of course, was the wedding.
What's the shot, this expression, chassan mol?
A meal for the chassan, a meal in honor of the chassan. That's exactly the expression. But here they have a different expression where they invite the poor people. But it's the same concept. It's the same concept that you're having a wedding, you're spending money, you have to do mitzvah. I can tell you with the Gerer Rebbe, the present, going back to, I think it was the Pnei Menachem, it's not that, it's two Rebbeim removed. So the Pnei Menachem, who I had the schut of meeting in person, I had a contact directly with him, with his niece, who was a great devotee of mine, so Zachiti, to have a chasida, which is Zichrona Levrach, who is a tzaddeket. She was a very, very interesting lady, a Gerer chasida, the Rebbe's niece, a Beis Yaakov girl who was a world-class financial genius. And I made a shidduch between her and I had other students whose parents inherited money. It goes back many years. And they organized an investment firm. The Israeli paper claims this investment firm is worth $2 billion today. So I asked my student, is this true? He says, Rebbe, you believe everything they write in the newspapers? I said, yeah, but they wouldn't write that about me. They're writing that about you with your picture. They wouldn't write that about me. So anyway, she was the president of this investment firm. So when her son got married, there are all types of rules and regulations in Gera, what you're allowed to spend on a wedding, how you're allowed to serve. So she wanted to make an elaborate Sheva Brachas, and the Rebbe wouldn't agree. Finally, she told the Rebbe, for every penny she spends on the Sheva Brachas, she will give matching funds to the Rebbe to distribute to tzedakah. Then the Rebbe agreed. So you can understand what this means when you're making an elaborate wedding, but here the Tomchei Tumimim, the students, had a beautiful Suda. And the day of the wedding, we have the description of the person that we just spoke about, who is the Rebbe Shomer. That day, a telegram arrived for the seventh Rebbe from his father. Your father, who is really and truly with you, Levi Yitzchak. You put yourself in the seventh Rebbe's place. This is his father, never thousands of miles apart. The day of the wedding, Elie Chaim writes, we went to the mikveh before Shachris. After davening, he learned and I ate. Then at the appropriate time, of course, he was fasting, right? Tanit Chasen. Now, again, it's interesting here, there's a role reversal. Who knows what I'm about to say? If you're into brisk theology, you should chop me. It's very simple. Generally speaking, a Litvak fast and a Chasid drinks. You talk about a Yahrzeit. How do Litvakin observe a Yahrzeit? Remember, the Rebbe used to fast, teach Mishnayot all day. I can still see the site in room 102. He would daven, say Kaddish, the Yahrzeit, his father, his mother, the day of the Yahrzeit, and all day he would teach Mishnayos. People would walk in, people would walk out. It was unbelievable. And fasting yet. That a chassid, ma machta l'chayim, the neshama zalchaben an aliyah, a hilula, a sudat hilula. And here with the wedding day, exactly the opposite. Rabbi Chaim Brisker was very choshesh for fasting. It affects your health. I don't want to reveal secrets, but there are very few Brisker who fast on the minor fast days all day. Let's put it that way. So Rabbi Chaim, who was always choshesh, and Yom Kippur was always a machmir pikuach nefesh, came to the Tainet Chatan Vakala. So he told the Pesha, that this is written up in Shulamit Meislam in Rebbetzin Pesha's daughter, the Rebbe's sister, the Rebbe's mother. Reb Chaim told Pesha that on a fast day, if you'd feel a little weak, a sudat chatan has no sauce, you don't have to fast. And Pesha had, was a woman of independence, said to Reb Chaim, I don't have to ask you questions. Mein Tat is a Paisek, Yishprizhana Rav, Rav Elia Feinstein, Rav Meishin is of the Feinstein's family. And she said, I'll ask my father what to do. And of course, he passed and she asked to fast. But here you see that Litvak can take a lenient attitude, a fast, because of nefesh, you don't feel good, you've got a headache. I know that the Rav Paschim Lalacha, Rabbi Hanan Weinberg, remember Charlie Weinberg told me, He once wasn't feeling well on a fast day, on a minor fast day. So the Rav says, you have a headache? You feel you have to lie down? You're allowed to eat. And you take a cup of coffee, you'll feel better. You know, the Rav already knew evidently that our whole problem with fasting is caffeine withdrawal symptoms. But here, you see the opposite. That here is the seventh Rebbe, a Lubavitcher Chassid, and he is fasting mincha time. He daments with tremendous kavana, and he says the vidui. He stands before the one who knows the secrets of the world, the lengthy vidui with great concentration, pouring out his heart in a low voice, the awesome and frightening sight, but nobody there but me and him. Two people as distant from each other as the East is from the West. For his thoughts are my thoughts. For his thoughts are not my thoughts. And this is a chassid speaking. In other words, he already is worshipping the Rebbe. This Elie Chaim is already viewing the Rebbe. Who can be like him viewing the seventh Rebbe? What Kedusha, what Tahara. And all day the Rebbe is learning, and the Rebbe is involved in Alma, on thoughts, esoteric thoughts, way beyond this world. And then a telephone arrives. Is the chassan ready? They'll soon be calling him to chuppah. And he puts on his kapata, puts on the gatel, the door opens, and his elder son-in-law of the sixth Rebbe, Reb Shmaya Guraye, and the Rebbe's uncle, this is the Hornstein family, later from that family, he there's a Hornstein who marries the Rebbe's youngest daughter, Shena, who lo aleinu, they're killed in the Holocaust, and they come in to bring the Rebbe to chuppah. Now, Hasidic tradition, and this too is interesting, by Winsel Litvakin, what happens at a wedding? So you machabed the Masada Kedushin. Generally speaking, who's Masada Kedushin? It's the Talmud's Rosh Yeshiva. Obviously, the Rosh Yeshiva is the most important person in the Talmud's life and the Chatan's life. Then you machabed someone to read the Ketuvah. You have Sheva Brachas. You all know our minig is the first two brachot. We don't make a hefsek, only if you have so many rabbanim, you have no choice. I mean, it's a machloikis poskim. You machabit different people. At a Hasidic wedding, the Rebbe does everything. There are no other kibbutim. Very interesting. So the sixth Rebbe was Masada Kedushin, said all Sheva brachas. No one else played a role at the Siddur Kedushin. And here I'll tell you in parentheses, hold on one second, Moshe, I'll tell you in parentheses, and this I saw with my own eyes, but there are many stories about it, that the Rav, many times at a wedding when the Talmud was Mechabed, the Rav was Siddur Kedushin, the Rav took it further and was Mechabed someone else. He refused to be Masada Kedushin in front of someone who considered a Gaon and a Tzaddik. And there's a classic example when there's a famous graduate of Yeshiva University who's run Pras Yisrael by the name of Yaakov Blitzstein. I know him as Jerry Blitzstein. Recognize the name Jerry Blitzstein, a graduate of BTA, studied there with Dr. Yechiel Lichtenstein, winds up in Yeshiva University. His grandfather was the Mabid, Rabbi Yamin Moshe Kamishov, a very famous Rav in Brooklyn, a Litvisha, and Jerry, Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein considered Jerry Blitzstein the most brilliant graduate that his father ever produced. Be aware of it. He's in Be'er Sheva. He has little to do with YU today. He's been in Be'er Sheva, professor. He's retired today. Labriot, professor of Jewish thought, published Svarim on the Rambam, on a very interesting, learned, erudite individual. Jerry Blitzstein. If you don't know him, it's worth getting to know him. All the 5'2", 5'3". I think Steve Riskin is even taller than Jerry Blitzstein. And Jerry is skinny. You think you can blow him over, but what a mind. So at his wedding in Queens, he's Mechabed the Rebbe, and I witnessed to this. And the Rebbe gets up and says, "My commentary, it's hard for me to say it in English because I'm living it in Yiddish. I'll say it in Yiddish and then I'll translate into a Goyish language. My commentary, me Mechabed Yevon, Sezayin Mesadeh Kedushin. Ebet me Mechabed Yevon, Lesadeh, ich vet das Mesadeh sein, und ich bin, ich ruf on, Harab Nisim Tlushkin, Agon bi Yisrael, as Rav Tlushkin, Sezayin Mesadeh Kedushin." And at the wedding, the Rav said, "My Talmud was mechabed me to work out the kedushin." He played with the words, "Lesadeh kedushin, ich vetas mesadeh zayin." I will work it out. And a mechabed Reb Nissim Plushkin, lesadeh kedushin. And you see, it's an amazing thing. At the Baruch Lichtenstein's wedding, exactly the same thing. Now, who remembers? Who's going to be mesadeh kedushin? Rabarin is marrying Tova, okay? Tova Soloveitchik. Mitzad the Kalim, it's the Rav. Mitzad the Chatan, it's the Rav. And the Rav is Mechabed, the person there that he looked up to, that he respected more than anyone else. Rav Moshe was there, Rav Shmuel Balkan was there, Rav Tamalevich was there. The Tonga Rebbe was there. It's Mechabed, Rav Leisa Silva. You follow? The Rav wouldn't be Mesadeh Kedushin in front of Reb Leisa. You have to understand what their relationship was. The world doesn't understand. From my research and from conversation with the Rav, I understand it very well. When the Rav came to America, this was his prototype. This was, Reb Leisa was the person the Rav wanted to be like in the 30s into the 40s. Then things happened in Boston. The Kashrut scandal, the accusations, the aggravation, the Akmas Nefesh, the Birchat Kohanim, if you know what I'm saying, which is a minor incident, but it's indicative of Boston of the 30s. Then the Rav found himself in a little classroom in Washington Heights with 15, 20 students, and out of that classroom he became the Rav. But that love and admiration for a blaze of silver remained constant. I told you so many times. That's in a Litvisha world. In a Hasidic world, there's only one person that counts, the Rebbe. The sixth Rebbe, the Riatz, he's the focal figure. And he was Masada everything. Now, what's fascinating is who came to the wedding. This is 1928. There were plenty of Hasidic Rebbeim, the Amshanava, the Novominska. But there were two giants of Hasidic stock, origin, lifestyle, who were Gaonei Yisrael. One of them, and these are two names that all of you should have heard of. One of them was, of course, Reb Meir Shapiro. Reb Meir Shapiro, who was a Gaon Adir. Everyone knows him for the Daf Yomi. But he was a lot more than the Daf Yomi. He was the founder of Yeshivat Chachmei Lublin, Yachal. If you talk about Rav Wuzna was a Talmud of Yachal, of Yeshivat Chachmei Lublin. And that was a very unique yeshiva, again, for the Hasidic world. It was overwhelming. Can anyone tell me why? Because it was the first Hasidic yeshiva that was for all Hasidim. You see, Tomchei Tamimim, to be a student in Tomchei Tamimim, basically by definition, you had to be a Chabatnik. You understand? You're not going to go there unless you're a Chabatnik, unless you're willing to become a Chabatnik, unless you have a Zikah, you have an attachment, a connection to Chabad. But you had Chabad, you had Sfat Emet. Go into Sfat Emet today and ask in Sfat Emet, who here is a Gerecha, is a Lubavitcher Chassid? They'll laugh at you. Go in and say, who's a Vishnitsa? And you have to be a Gera. Go into Chabad. Go into Lubavitch. Tomchei Tamimim. You have to be a Lubavitcher. Yeshivat Chachmei Lublin was the first yeshiva that it had a Hasidic overtone. Everyone davened with the gatel. They davened Nusach Sfarad. But It didn't matter whether you are Novominska, whether you are Namshinaba, whether you were Gera, whether you were Chambatnik. It was a real yeshiva with Gedolei Rashi yeshiva, led by the Maram Lublin, led by Rameyah Shapiro. Now, he was a Gaon Adir. The other person was, of course, Reb Menachem Zemba. Reb Menachem Zemba, one of the most fascinating individuals, one of the greatest Gedolim killed by Hitler, died in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, died on Shabbos Cholamayit Pesach, with bullets were flying. He came yet to Kfurat Yisrael. He was a Gain Shebegainim, but he was a Chassid. He went to work. He had a hardware store in a suburb of Warsaw, in Praga. He had a hardware store. Chassid, a balabas, a Gaon Adir. Later, with problems of finances, with anti-Semitism, he was forced to close down his business, and he became an avbeistin in Warsaw. And again, I'll move sideways just for 1 second, just to make the picture complete. Reb Menachem Zemba, we'll never know for sure. And I can tell you, on one hand, I had a source. On the other hand, Rafi, I got my head chopped off. And I don't mind getting my head chopped off, Baruch Hashem. In scholarship, just this morning, I remember, I don't know if I told you, but I had gotten evidently a master's thesis on the Weberman family. When we spoke about Malachim, it caused a lot of interest across the world. And people sent this to me, so I can't keep everything. It's I read it, and you know, sometimes I'll Xerox what I need for my notes. But I passed it on to Sam Dershowitz. Why did I pass it on to Sam Dershowitz? Because Sam's grandfather, great-grandfather, was Zachariah Dershowitz, great-granduncle, whatever the relationship was. These are among the founders of Yiddishkeit in Brooklyn and Torah V'das in America. So I passed it on to Sam. So Sam was very, very upset with the article because he said he lived it. He lived the period. Not everything there is correct. So I told Sam, don't get upset. You're a scientist. You have a PhD in fabric chemistry. You're in your world. Your world is science. Everything has to make sense and be correct. I'm a historian. You know what a historian is? He tries to predict the past. Underline the word predict. So here, if you read Hillel Zeidman's memoir, Yoman Washo, you've heard the name Rabbi Dr. Hillel Zeidman, Zichrono Levracha, a survivor, one of the few survivors of the Warsaw Ghetto. So when you read his memoir, he talks about in his memoir how they asked Reb Menachem Zemba what to do before the Warsaw Uprising, people who were from and didn't know what to do, to go to fight, to put your life on the line, to get killed, but at least to kill a few Nazis, bring them down. So he attributed to him, in Yoman Warsaw, there may be an English translation, by the way, of the book, Warsaw Diaries, perhaps. I have the Hebrew originally. So Reb Menachem Zemba said that Kiddush Hashem is open to definition. Originally, Kiddush Hashem meant giving your life. But when they want to uproot and kill the entire Jewish people, Kiddush Hashem has a different meaning altogether. It means the Jews should fight and kill as many Germans as possible. And Reb Menachem Zemba attributes to, Dr. Hillel Zeidman attributes to Reb Menachem Zemba the okay, the go-ahead, the heksha for the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. And I published that. Years later, I got a call from the late great historian Lucy Davidovitz, Lucy Davidovitz. You know the name I'm mentioning? She taught at Stern College. So she asked me, what's your source for what you published in that article on Reb Menachem Zemba? So I told her, Hillel Zeidman. So she told me, no, you can't depend upon him. A lot of what he wrote in Warsaw Ghetto was his imagination and not reality. So I throw it out to you. We don't know what Reb Menachem Zemba really said. It would be interesting to bring Esther Farbstein here, Dr. Farbstein, and see what she has to say, because she is caught between two worlds. Esther Farbstein, on one hand, is from the Farbstein family, from the Levush Mordechai's family. Her husband is Rosh Yeshiva of Chevron. She comes from certainly a Haredi background, although she taught my daughters in Chorev, which I wouldn't call exactly a Haredi school, far from it today. But on the other hand, she has done magnificent research, PhD, Hebrew U, which she cannot publicize because it's a pastnish for the Chevron of Rosh Yeshiva's wife to have a PhD. By the way, I believe that the Pnei Menachem's wife had a PhD in English literature from the Hebrew U as well. I met her at the Sheva Brachas, and when she opened her mouth in English, she made me look like a greenhorn in English. So, and they told me afterwards that she has, I believe they told me, a PhD from the Hebrew U, also cannot be publicized among the Hasidim, the Rebbe's Freud had a doctorate from Hebrew University, but among the more enlightened Hasidim, they had great respect and charism. When she walked into the room, everyone jumped up. I saw such covet. If anyone ever tells me that we put down women, I'll punch them in the nose, and if I don't do it, I'll call. I have grandsons who are much stronger than I am, much taller than I am, much more powerful. Okay, so.
Moshe Aarons published a book on the Mosul Ghetto.
Who published? Who published?
Moshe Aarons.
Yeah.
Because everything that has been written before him was written from the Mapai anti-revisionist.
Right, point of view. Yeah.
Gave another side of the question.
Okay.
Yeah,
no, I don't know what he has to say about this, but I know in his book, I read reviews of it, he portrays the role of the Chirutnikim, and that they played a much bigger role than the Mapai gives them credit for. All right, this is Milchemet HaYehudim, it's called. But why am I telling you this? Because the sixth Rebbe was showing off the seventh Rebbe. Look at the son-in-law I am getting. And he forced the seventh Rebbe to talk in learning at the wedding during the Sheva Brachas, whenever these meetings took place with the Maram Lublin, with the Maram Shapiro, with Rav Meir Shapiro, and with Rav Menachem Semba. And the word went out all over the world that he's a golden idea. And you have to understand, the Rebbe's personality at this time was very reticent. He was, as the Rav put it, no one would ever guess that he would become the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who he became the seventh Rebbe. He was nechbal akelim, reticent, withdrawn, all his life learning, photographic memory, nechbal akelim. Who could ever dream? And by the way, I have to say, if you knew Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, a lot of what I just said a minute ago applies to Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein. He was the babe. He was the babe. He was blessed with a photographic memory. His davening. I remember as a kid, you saw him davening in the Beis Medrash. Where did we come to him? And yet he was one of the boys. It was amazing. Yet a little schnook like yours truly could come into the yeshiva in 51, a little kid of 13 years old from the Bronx, and one of my good friends as a kid, 4.5 years older than me, who we called the babe. We used to play basketball with him, and you could already ask him a shayla, and yet he was nechbal hakelim. There were two individuals in the yeshiva there was another fellow, Gershon Sadowski, and they were just something special. And both of them were reticent, withdrawn, didn't push, weren't showy. They were unbelievable individuals, role models. There was a third person in yeshiva, but already then he was a storm. He was a thunderbolt. He was lightning. That was Duvi Hartman. I can never forget, I write about it in Washington, when the Chazon Ish died, Duvi stormed into the Beis Medrash. It has to be 53, I believe. Stormed into the Beis Medrash. Sit down on the floor. Availut, And everyone looked at him. The Chazon Ish has died. And before you know it, the 50, 60 people were sitting on the floor. We're ready to rip Kriya. Dubi, what a different personality. Go and dream what would become of them 50, 60, 70 years later. So the Rebbe, the seventh Rebbe, Alapov Chamaso V'chamato, had to talk and learning with Gedolei Gedolei Yisrael. Now, what's also interesting is how they celebrate, what Chabad did. And here, the sixth Rebbe got up and said, a maima chassidut. But it wasn't just a maima chassidut. It was a maima where the Rebbe said, we have a minhag in the Hasidic world. We believe that when we make a wedding, our parents, our grandparents from that are gone from the other side of creation, from the Olam HaEmet, come to the wedding. But special Jews have even more schut. Many generations come to the wedding. And he went and said a maimer chassidus, quoting the Alter Rebbe, the Mittler Rebbe, the Tzemach Tzedek, he quoted Reb Shmuel, the Rashab, he quoted from all the Rebbeim, from the Chatan's Yichus as well, which is different than the Rebbe's, than the previous Rebbe's Yichus, beginning from the Tzemach Tzedek. He quoted from all of them in the Maima Chassidus. And then he breaks into a niggun, and every niggun in advance he would announce, this niggun is from the Alter Rebbe, this niggun is from the Mittler Rebbe, this niggun is from the Tzemach Tzedek. He united everyone with all the Chassidic generations that were before, both with Divrei Torah and both with Chassidut. Now, the description of the Mashke and what was put out for the Hamon Ha'am, for the Talmidim, everyone who came, the Rebbe went around, very fascinating, the sixth Rebbe, I have to be careful what I say because it's the sixth and seventh, the sixth Rebbe went around with a towel on his shoulder, holding a bottle of mashke, holding little cups in the other hand, and pouring for the Talmidim and the Chosheva guest. Each one should get mashke from the sixth Rebbe. This is Shirayim. Aye, why the towel on his shoulder? So of course, any lady would answer right away, the towel on his shoulder, so he shouldn't get his bekesha dirty. The Rebbe said, I'm going like this because at my wedding, this is what my father, Reb Shalom Dovber, did, and he gave out the mashke with a towel on his shoulder. And you see, this is Chassidus. In the Litvische Welt, this one goes with a towel, this one doesn't go with a towel. In the Hasidic world, we reached the conclusion that Yomo is not complete. Do you remember why? Because he doesn't know how to ride a horse. You follow? The Rebbe knew how to, he didn't know how to drive a car. Could you imagine the seventh Rebbe said this publicly at a chitvadot? And he believes it. And he believes it. And the man in those kol haTorah, kol habaalpeh, and he believes it. This is Chassidus. This is Chassidus. This is where we Litvakin fail. You understand? We Litvakin fail. I have to say, we Litvakin fail. We don't have this awe. We don't have this feeling. We don't have this feeling of the generations uniting and being real. You need the rough to hit you over the head with a shmuis and pleitats of rehem to bring home this thought. A chassid sees it. The Rebbe with a towel on his shoulder. And why? Now, hold on 1 second. The seventh Rebbe revealed that he wanted to give out mashke too. It's his wedding. And the sixth Rebbe made him sit. You're the Chatan, Chatan doim lemelech, and the seventh Rebbe said publicly, Chab gizetzen av spilkis. Now go and explain that in English. Not so simple. Ich hab gesetzen auf Spilkes. You know, how would you train? You know, you're sitting there, you want to get up auf Spilkes. I don't know what it means either. I just know what the words mean. I know what the words convey. Auf Spilkes. Ich will Lufsteinstein. Ich will Tonepis. I want to do something. But the sixth Rebbe would not allow him. Okay, yes. I know you don't know how to ride a horse, neither do I. So neither of us qualify in the Hasidic world. We know how to drive, but not more.
You just called Rebbe, but I don't think the Rebbe actually meant physical horse. It's a code word for Nefesh HaBahamas.
We're getting here a whole Hasidic discourse.
In a complete control of his animal side.
So I will stand from what I said, from my understanding of what was written and what was said by Chabadnikim. It meant the Rebbe Pshuto Kumashmo. If you don't know how to ride a horse, you're nishta ganse mensch, because this is the sixth Rebbe. Yomo was saying the Rebbe meant, it meant a horse, it represents Tava, Bahaimis, and the Shama HaBahamit, which the Baal Tanya talks about, and it meant the Rebbe knows how to ride a horse to control his Neshama Bahamit. I throw it out to the Chabadnikim listening. Is Rakefet right, or is Yomo right? Are we both right? And please, no Kavod HaRav here. You don't have to say the Mechilat Kvod Cha. You see the Yachas Yomo has for his Rebbe, Baruch Hashem. But if I'm wrong, I'll be happy to admit it. Nothing gives me greater pleasure to say I'm wrong. But you got to prove I'm wrong, because the Pashat Pshat I got from all the descriptions was the Rebbe Taka said, if you don't know how to drive or to ride a horse, min zayt nishta odem shalim, min zayt nishta ganse mensch. Period. Okay, and then it was an all-night affair, the Sheva Brachas, the wedding took place. Okay. Now I want to move sideways. And here's the sad part. And here it takes you into the world, and it's a world which I saw with my own eyes. What went on in the Rebbe's home in Yekaterinoslav, if I'm pronouncing it right, that's where Rav Levi Yitzchak was Rav now. And here we have the miracle of survival that Rebbetzin Chana, the Rav's mother, survived the Holocaust, survived Siberia. Her husband died in exile. Her husband suffered. It's so sad what the communists did. And as Moriu Rebbe said, as the Rav said, I write about it in Washington, I write about it in the Rav, the World of. The Rav said, communism didn't have to be anti-religious. The concept of the worker having rights, of workers of the world unite, you could have and have it with religion. There was no need, but somehow they so resented religion that it was like belief in religion, and particularly the Catholic Church, the hierarchy, that put down the worker. But Yiddishkeit, excuse me? The Russian Orthodox Church, okay, the hierarchy, absolutely. Thank you for the correction, you're absolutely correct. But why the Jews, Judaism, with us a worker, Sheisha German Tassel, Malach Techa, Vyamashvikot Shlashemalokecha, we never disdained work at all. And yet what they suffered. So here are the parents in a city far, far away from Warsaw. Now, Chana survived, and as you know, when she reached France, the Rebbe was able to get her out. She reached France. The Rebbe came from New York to France to bring her to America. This was after World War II. I believe it's before, I believe, he became officially Rebbe. You can correct me if I'm wrong. And his mother lived almost, I believe, something like 19 years until she died, lived in the Eastern Parkway neighborhood, and of course had great nachat to see who her son had become. The Rebbe, the seventh Rebbe, visited his mother every single day. If I learn to visit my mother every day, a part of it I learned from the 7th Lubavitcher Rebbe. Now, she wrote a memoir that came out in an installment, and I read everything that came out. I don't believe a book has come out yet. I imagine ultimately they will put the memoir together, edit it a little bit better, maybe add more material, background material. It should be a very fascinating and inspiring volume. But in the memoir, she writes about what went on the day of the wedding. Now, it's a very interesting description of the communist era. This story, what's going to come up now in the memoir, comes up time and again if you study the communist period. The Jews were suffering. The Jews were being persecuted. But wherever you turned, there was a communist Jew of high rank, of authority. Jews were very successful in the communist system. There was basically little anti-Semitism in the communist system until Stalin became paranoid. Lenin, it's very fascinating, Lenin had Jewish blood in him. We've established that today. After the communist empire fell, documents became available. In the mid-20s, before he died, Lenin recorded about, I think it was 6 or 7 speeches, messages to the Russian people about the worker, the rights of the worker, the concept of the motherland, the concept of brotherhood throughout the world. And one talk was on his total disdain for anti-Semitism. What's fascinating is years later, all the talks were reproduced and made available to the Russian public except one talk, the talk on anti-Semitism. Moshe, wherever you turn, there's stories about people who were caught up with difficult problems, such as World War II, being drafted, being sent to the front, and this big, famous woman doctor is examining you, and she's filing the forms, and suddenly you find you were exempt from the Russian army. And she whispers to the person in Yiddish, "Vi kenich nemen a yeshiva bachan in shikinem es ol dahaget varen." How can I take a yeshiva boy and send him to the front where he will be killed? And you'll see stories like this come up time and again. Even Gromyko's wife, who was Jewish, he was foreign minister of Russia, she was Jewish. When Golda Meir came, she said to Golda Meir, "Ich bin Echid, a Yiddishe Tachta. I too am a Jewish daughter." This will explain to you why Stalin became so paranoid. I've told you time and again, when Golda Meir came, the first ambassador from the State of Israel to Russia, and Golda Meirson, announced at the Israeli embassy, she will appear in the Moscow synagogue, the Choral synagogue, the only active synagogue, I believe it was on Rosh Hashanah. 50,000 Jews came out to view her. That's the famous picture. If you talk about a person who hits a crescendo once in his life, Ein lecha dam shein lo sha'ah, there is no person that doesn't have an ultimate moment of greatness. That's the picture of Golda Meir, standing surrounded by the throng, by the Jews, in front of the sign that you enter the synagogue in Moscow, Ein zeh ki ela beit Elokim v'zeh shar ha-shamayim. I have a picture of Malcolm myself standing in front of that sign in 81 already, January 81. So Stalin went paranoic that the Jews still believe in a national Jewish existence? The Jews still believe in Judaism? The Jews still consider themselves a separate, unique people? And that's where Stalin launched that tremendous plan, Lo Aleinu, to send the Jews to Siberia. He was already building concentration camps. And then you had the miracle. Stalin dies. And you know what's said about Stalin's death? You can read all the books. Books have been written, memoir literature. All the good Jewish doctors who could have prolonged his life were in jail. And the only doctors he had available were Goyish doctors, two-thirds drunk on vodka, and he died suddenly. Then the story continues with Khrushchev. Now, why is this introduction important? Because now you can understand what happened in the seventh Rebbe's parents' house the day of the wedding. They said they wanted to do something, wanted to have a simcha, wanted to invite the Jews to rent a hall for such an occasion in these hostile times, I'm quoting from the Rebbe's mother now, from Rebbe Tzimchana, was unthinkable. In addition, the ruling authorities had appropriated much of our apartment. Only three rooms remained for our use. The major part had been reassigned to others who then became our new neighbors. And yes, this was the communist takeover. This is the whole shaila that Reb Moshe was asked after the revolution. Can you buy a car produced in a communist factory where the owner was robbed? This factory was taken over. The owner was exiled. The owner was shot. The owner was executed. He was never paid. Are you allowed to buy a car? It's gezeilah. The government took it over. Mamash gezeilah. This is l'ar hayom with force. Are you allowed? A very interesting question. Dina de Malchut de Dina, or is this Chamsina de Malchut Hamas? You follow me, Vic? Don't tell me Dina de Malchut de Dina. This is Hamas. So here they took over apartments. I saw apartments in Russia, beautiful apartments. They split them into three different areas, three different families. They shared a kitchen. They shared a bathroom. You have no idea the way they live. They could be Jews and Goyim living in one apartment in separate parts of the apartment. This was the communist system. This is why communism ultimately fell. So they had three rooms left in their beautiful apartment. In those days, sizable groups of people still came to our home to hear words of Hasidus and to participate in Fabrengens during the festivals. Our next-door neighbor, an engineer. Now, it's interesting. She doesn't tell us whether this engineer is Jewish or not Jewish. My gut guess is he's Jewish. I don't know. If anyone knows, if any Chabadnik has researched this, she doesn't tell us. Our next-door neighbor, an engineer, could not tolerate the religious activities that took place in our home. And he would lock himself in his rooms to ensure that there was no hint of connection between us. However, when he heard from someone else that we were trying to arrange something for the occasion of the wedding, he proceeded to break through the outer wall that separated his dwelling from ours in order to create a passageway between the two. He then removed all his furniture and allowed us to use his entire living space for as long as we needed it. Thus we obtained the sufficiently large area in which to hold our celebration, despite being forced to have given up the largest rooms of our dwelling to our new neighbors. Now, this tells you something. If it was a Jew, it shows you the Pinterly Yid Bleib. If it was a guy, it shows you that you can't raise, educate, to hate Goyim. Among the non-Jews, there are people with wonderful souls. Either way, there's an important message here. As I've said more than once, you have to treat every human being with respect. If someone lifts a stone to throw at us, that's a different story. But until that moment, he has the chazakah, cheskat, decency. He's a human being created in the image of the Ribbono Shel Olam. Ah, Now that we had a hall, we sent out invitations to the affair. The occasion provided an opportunity for the townspeople to express their appreciation and esteem for my husband, the Rav, this is Levi Yitzchak. His spiritual influence in the city was so great that the celebration was not seen as a private one. It had taken on the form of a religious demonstration. It must not be forgotten that in those days it was forbidden to have any association with a religious leader, and to be found guilty of this sin was cause enough to be dismissed from one's job. It was a time when a rabbi was afraid to appear in public because of the suspicion that surrounded such a class of men. Owing to the threatening nature of the situation that prevailed, we expected less than 30 guests. Instead, about 300 people from the city and the surrounding area came to our simcha that our son was getting married. Large numbers of doctors and judges that held respected positions in the communist hierarchy and the city councils. And once again, it shows you the Pintel Yid, that there's something there, that these Jews, communists, assimilated, part of the system, good jobs, and yet they came out to celebrate with the Rav and the Rebbetzin. Listen to this. In addition, congratulatory telegrams came pouring in by the hundreds. Special permission was granted for the day and the next, enabling us to receive telegrams in Hebrew, a language that was absolutely forbidden. Also, an order was issued that day that all telegrams for the Schneerson family concerning the wedding would not be subject to censorship, in order that the delivery should not be impeded. I mean, you have to understand, this is the communist system. You don't know what the communist system was. I can tell you what the Mossad system was. I hope I'm not going to go to jail for revealing these secrets. But I would walk into the boss, my handler, and he hated one part of my life, had absolutely enmity that I taught in Mechwala. He was from Kibbutz Adati, Kibbutz Sad, and there was a girl from the kibbutz who had come to Mechwala, and she became Haredit. And he used to tell me, Aravre kefetz al pusha shata od melamed for Mechwala. He used to have it. So one day I walk into his office, and he throws at me, he throws me a Xerox of a letter. Every letter going out from here to Russia, from Russia to here, was intercepted, Xerox, resealed. You got the letter. You never knew that anybody opened it. And what was the letter he was carrying on about? It was one of my friends from Russia who got out, had come in Aliyah. Yitzhak, he was caught between the two groups. He was not part of the SS group, not part of the Machanayim, but friendly with both. Of course, by 1985, there was already a Machloikis and Muhammad in Moscow, and when I got out, I wrote the report for the Mossad, and I said, there is a wonderful sign that Jewish life has been resuscitated in Moscow because the prim Jews are killing each other. Baruch Hashem, if there's machlaikit, it's a sign of life. When there's no machlaikit, likmin in dread, there are no Jews, we Jews have to fight, that's it, I'm kishayorif. You can't change any word in the Torah. Torah says, meram kishayorif, meram kishayorif. Look at Panovich, I have to go further. What are we talking about? God have mercy. I was happy, everyone is crying, I was dancing a kazanska, Baruch Hashem. Machloket in Moscow. Machloket in Moscow. So what was he writing? He was writing to his friends in Russia. Living in Russia prepares you for living in Israel. I'm quoting Kamat word by word this letter. He wrote it in Russian, and my handler read Russian, but there was a Hebrew translation prepared for the staff in the Mossad, so they should know what we're dealing with. What do we do in Russia? We lie to the government. We cheat the government. We work in a factory. We take home cans of fish that we're not allowed to take. We barter it. That's the way we live. The hell with the government. In Israel, you got to make money under the table. If you're going to just rely upon your official salary that taxed away, you're not going to be able to live. But you got to live here like you lived in Moscow to cheat, to sneak. And that's very good training for the state of Israel. Harav Rakase, Eisa Chavarim Yeshlecha. In Russia, there used to be mailboxes, one for local mail. Like in Israel, they had it for a while. Now there are no mailboxes whatsoever. There's no mail whatsoever. I get invitations to weddings. 2 weeks after the wedding, I get requests for money, tzedakah that I give to these tzedakah that I know are reliable. I got after Pesach, once a week we're lucky if we get mail, it's beyond words, but the email and faxes have put the post office out of business, and I protest because my father was a postman, and I was a postman the first part of the Yom Kippur War. I volunteered, I was a postman. The second part, I was in the army as a volunteer. Yomo. So the refusnik came as we're walking, and I see this mailbox, outside Russia, international, Russia, beautiful system. Hey, what are you, a dummy? All the mail you put in goes to the censorship first. Then they take their time, they read it, Nitnita Bisul Vodka, they're a little drunk, they'll put off tomorrow what they should have done today. So you get your mail a week late, doesn't matter which box you put it into. This is what the Rebbetzin is saying. See, if you don't make a footnote on this, no one will understand what's the big deal. They didn't order censorship. How long does censorship take? Censorship? Ich komme heinz, zu tragen morgen, zu trachten dienstig, mint, it's a whole thing. Thursday, Friday, who can you do something Friday? Shabbos is Shabbos. A week later, they'll look at it, they'll reseal it, and send it out. Could you imagine? No censorship the day of the wedding. I do not have, then I'm quoting from the Rebbetzin again. It's a beautiful document. I do not know how to convey in words the emotional atmosphere that reigned in our house that evening. Everyone present shared our sorrow that we were unable to participate in the joy of the wedding of our son, our oldest child. It was sensed that there would be no possibility in the immediate future for us to see our son, and the intense longing and anguish that we felt was experienced by all. For a long time, the Rav, when she says the Rav, she means the seventh Rebbe's father, her husband, Reb Levi Yitzchak, danced with his father-in-law and his brother, danced with her father, in other words, and his brother. All eyes were on the dancers, and not a soul was able to hold back their tears. Such was our rejoicing. With the break of day, the gathering dispersed, everyone going to his place of work. Everyone had been deeply affected by the spiritual influence of the Rav, which had transported them to another world. At this point, no one was thinking about the heavy price he was liable to pay for having participated in the unforgettable celebrations of the previous night. As the guests were departing, two of them approached me, Dr. Baruch Mutzkin and a lawyer, Mr. Turovatsky, who was a grandson of the renowned sage Reb Yitzchak Elchanan Spector. They said to me, quote, such a night, a unique experience. We will not easily forget this extraordinary gathering, nor the amazing spiritual power of this man, your husband, Reb Levi Yitzchak. Now that's a very interesting comment on Reb Yitzchak Elchanan Spector. The overwhelming majority of his family was caught behind the Soviet Union. Many of them became communist devotees. Many were wiped out during the Holocaust. There are very few descendants of the great Reb Yitzchak Elchanan Spector. alive today. And here she writes about one. It would be interesting to know what ultimately happened to that family. And she describes the people who all had such important positions. And most remarkable, one of the chairmen of the local councils, he exclaimed, "The wedding took place abroad. The bride and groom were very far from Yakontreskulov, yet the celebration here made an impact. What a power this man has. Whenever he petitions us, we're unable to refuse him, even though his requests always involve religious matters." And you see, this is a guy, communist, atheist, man of influence. But the Rebbe's father was the Rebbe's father. There was still that pintle yud that could be blown away by the man's Kedusha v'tahara. Then she describes the celebration. And here it's important for us because you'll see who plays the role. The eminent chassid, Rav Moshe Dvorkin, played his violin, the famous melody of the Alter Rebbe. Rabbi Zalman Vilenkin, who are we talking about, Rabbi Zalman Vilenkin? This was the seventh Rebbe's Cheder Rebbe, right or wrong, who had been one of the first childhood teachers of the seventh Rebbe, danced on the table. He probably had a lot of vodka. Danced on the table shouting, "Ich hab Zeiche gewen." I had the merit to teach such a person like your son, Reb Menachem Mendel. The city's two rabbinical judges, non Hasidim, were bursting with joy. One of them, a little tipsy at the time, put his jacket on inside out and danced as merrily as it has been his own celebration. And that too, a Litvisha Dayan, putting his jacket on inside out and dancing with joy. The most beautiful part that she describes is that Reb Levi Yitzchak, and here too we come to a Hasidic custom. Those of you who saw the display at the museum on Hasidus, how many of you saw it? How many of you saw it? It was something very, very special. I felt it was the most beautiful show that the museum put together. I may be prejudiced because it was on Yiddishkeit. The Herodian was very good, but this was something so special the way they put it together. So one part that, there were two parts that drew a lot of negative comment. One part was the Shirayim, remember, with the chicken being thrown around. And, you know, a person who doesn't understand Hasidus looks at that and you know, he's turned off. What are these primitives? Okay, Lubavitch, as I told you, the Rebbe did it very, very differently, where there was no primitivism. It was just kichel and shops and schnapps and vodka and drinking l'chaim and a little bit wine. He didn't see schnapps. He saw vodka and wine at 770. The other part that drew a lot of negative comment was the mitzvah tanz. And this is a Hasidic tradition where the Rebbe, where after all in the Hasidic world, men and women don't look at each other, men and women don't see each other. If you're a Gera Hasid, you eat in separate rooms Friday night. I mean, I'm not playing games now. If you've ever seen, I once saw with my own eyes a family that got out of Russia. So their daughter got engaged, married today, many children, to a Gera Chassid. How did it happen? A Balat Shuva got involved with a Gera Chassid. How did they allow it? A Gera Chassid, it's a Balat Shuva. How can you? But it turned out that this Gera Chassid, his father ran away from Egypt in 1956. A Sfardi, an Egyptian, a Dat HaMizrach, 100%, ran away to England, got out alive. Where did he live in England? He came a teenager. He lived in Stamford Hill. Gera families adopted him in Stamford Hill. And this Egyptian youngster grew up mit a Leingebot, mit Preyes, mit a Spodek, a total Gera. Geret a Fliesich in Yiddish, spoke a fast, perfect Yiddish. Total Gera Chassid, the king's, the queen's English, a gera, a Pelish Yiddish, grew up, comes an aliyah to Israel. His son, it's the son of a Asfrad, an Edat HaMizrach, an Egyptian, he married this girl who came from Russia. So at the engagement party, they asked me to speak. Believe me, I had what to say. Now, they asked the boy to come into the room where there were women. I saw with my own eyes, I'll never forget this, a young man about to get married was shaking. It was dramatic. He had never been in a room before with women who were not his mother or his sisters. Shaking. I saw with my own eyes, get settled. Wow. And suddenly at a wedding, you have a mitzvah tanz, and the Rebbe dances with the challah. You saw at the museum, the movies, the wedding, the Rebbe, his daughter, mitanzt. They hold a long gato. No, a Litvat looks at it, doesn't understand it. But this is Hasidus. At this affair, in the Rebbe's father's home, as the festivities drew to a close, Rabbi Levi Yitzchak turned to his father-in-law, Rabbi Meir Shlomo Yanovsky, and made a request. Since there is a custom for the chassan and kala to dance a mitzvah tanz together at the conclusion of their wedding celebration, in light of the fact that they were not present, meaning the chatan and the kala were not present, would he step up and dance with his daughter, Rebbe Tzimchana, the Levi Yitzchak, the Rebbe's, seventh Rebbe's father, asked his father-in-law to dance with his wife. At first, Reb Meir Shlomo refused. But after Reb Levi Yitzchak repeated his request several times, he acquiesced and performed the mitzvah dance with his daughter. So here you have it, a beautiful description of the wedding by the seventh Rebbe's mother. She was there. She saw it. She experienced it. So look what you have. You might very well want to call it the wedding of the Roaring Twenties, before the Depression. It's 28. The sixth Rebbe will soon depart on a trip to America where he's going to raise heavy funds to sustain the Chabad Empire, particularly within the Soviet Union, within the communist wall that has been erected. Everyone is ecstatic. The sixth Rebbe is Zeicha. He has a son-in-law who knows Kol HaTorah Kula. A Gaon Adir, a Tzaddik, a chassid, a man who can live in the Western world and be uninfluenced by the negativism of the Western world. A man who is very different than his youngest brother, who evidently was just as bright as the Rebbe, but ultimately gets swept away by Western civilization. Here's the wedding. We discussed the Yufraf. We discussed the meal with the Tomchei Tamimim, with the B'nai Teira who study in the Chabad Yeshiva. We saw the wedding. Rabbi Menachem Zember, the Maram Shapiro, all the famous Rebbeim in Poland, the celebration in Rav Levi Yitzchak's home and Chana's home. And here's a young couple, Chaya Mushka, Rav Menachem Mendel. By the way, I understand these are the same names as the Tzemach Tzedek and his wife. And here they have to start out in life. And this young couple, who would ever dream that they would have more impact on the totality of the Jewish world than any other Jew alive, than any other Jew since Churban Bayit? What a story. So what awaits us. Number one, an analysis of their relationship. You will know that the Rebbe ultimately becomes totally devoted to the Jewish people. We'll talk about it. I'll give you examples. I'll make it very clear and very tangible. And a wife who is totally supportive. This is crucial. It's a childless couple. No children. How does that impact upon their lives? In addition, it's a family in the limelight with, unfortunately, heavy machloket, as we will see down the line. That's also a sad reality that the greatest families, inevitably, controversy crawls up into the families. I'll allude to it tonight in a vort that I'll say. If you chop it, you chop it. If not, we'll leave it for the future. Following the wedding, they go to Berlin. Why Berlin? They meet the Rav in Berlin. The attitude towards the Rav, relationship towards the Rav. So many different points of view on the Rav and the Rebbe. Okay, Rakefet also has a point of view. But I have a feeling my prediction of the past is fairly accurate. Okay, you'll see the various points of view. What I know, what I heard from the Rav, what I spoke with the Rebbe. I'm going to go beyond my article in Jewish Action. Very fascinating material. We have a lot to do. Halavai, we should finish everything I just mentioned this year. I have my doubts. But we have a lot more for next semester, whatever you want to call it, next month. Be'ezrat ha'notein la'yov koach. And I'm rolling on in... What did we do today? We just summarized. Yesterday, we finally ended with New York and the Masham and the letter that was found. Again, if anyone knows how they found that letter in the year 2000, about 90 years after it was written, if anyone knows how they found it, please let me know. But the letter is accurate. And boy, did we get advice. Rafi, when you go into the rabbinate, remember what the Masham wrote about paskening shyness if you're not on the scene. And then we started with England. I wouldn't miss next Sunday's shiur for all the rice in China. Rabbi Graubat giving Musa in Machne Yehuda in the marketplace, in the ward. Wow, what a sight. And we will live it. I can tell you this, I'm struggling to finish a Reuven. I must finish it this year. 2 years is genug on why Jews kill each other over an Erev in Flatbush. The ending will shock you, what I have uncovered due to my student Mark Shapiro, who sent me a very interesting volume that just came out. Tonight I remind you once again, before I come to the freebies, 8 o'clock, we daven Maariv. And following 8 is the memorial for Moreno Rabbeinu, Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, Zeichet Tzadik Lefracha. Hurts to say it, but that's the reality. Please pass this to Yitzchak. Okay? If anyone wants, I offered this yesterday, but I guess nobody reads Hebrew here. This is Yad Vashem's publication of right before the Yom HaShoah. It gives you a little bit biographical material on all the people that were selected to kindle the 6 memorial candles. If anyone's interested, this is evidently an article that appeared in a scholarly American Jewish Archives publication by Yosef Solomon. I know exactly who that is. It's on the Mizrahi movement in America. A belated but sturdy offshoot that deals with Europe and finally Mizrahi in America. And here's a printout from one of the early Mizrahi conventions 101 years ago. And who attended this convention Again, very fascinating. Convention held in Cincinnati. In other words, Orthodox Jews always like to go into the hotbed of Reform Judaism, which was Cincinnati. That's where the Hebrew Union College was, and they loved to hold conventions there and produce Jews with strimels, bekishes, kippot on their heads, beards, payas, and let the Reform Jews know that Am Yisrael Chai. This is a very interesting article that Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein would love. It's about Shmuel Yosef Agnon and the implications of the characters in some of his novels. It analyzes basically Oreach Natala Lun and the message that Shmuel Yosef Agnon is trying to get across. It's reprinted from Orthodox Forum. It's by Jeffrey Sachs. Jeffrey Sachs is an outstanding young man, a Talmud of Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, a wonderful scholar, and he evidently is very big. I've seen something recently where he dealt with Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein and literature, and he evidently is in both worlds, and I'm very proud that I know him. In addition, my Talmud Rabbi Steve Przanski, taking off on the book I quoted in class by John Sexton, a whole Musa Shmuis on the spirit of baseball. And let me tell you, Steve does a good job. This article I mentioned yesterday, it is fabulous. It is Joshua Prager. It just came out in the New York Times a few days ago. It is Joshua Prager meeting with Ralph Branca and discussing the fact that Ralph Branca is Jewish. What hurts about the article, and I know this as a fact, imagine Ralph Branca's mother's parents in Hungary, people who had 13 children. They have to be from, I would imagine. And when she comes to America, his mother, she writes to her parents, "Would you mind if I married a Catholic Italian and raised my children as Catholics?" And her parents say, "Go right ahead. Beyond my comprehension." And finally, I want to show you one of the finest gifts I got, the love and appreciation extended to me in Beit Shemesh, among other things, a mock-up on my book from Washington Avenue to Nofe Aviv. We welcome, and they put my title in, Rabbi Aaron Rakefet Roskoff. You don't need titles, but okay. But if they're putting titles, where's the doctorate? But it shows you no one relates to me as doctor, which is a compliment to me. It's Harav Rakefet, Baruch Hashem. And these are pictures out of the past, like the back of the book, my teaching, my dad's a student, Baylor Brown, sitting with me. And they also gave me a computer printout of students who, they when they studied me, and what they remember about me, what was unique of my classes. And I have to say, the microphone shows up all over the place. But what you don't realize is that, I don't want to say my age, but you all know, Baruch Hashem, we're in smelling distance of a ninth generation. And Ani Modeh LaKadosh Baruch Hu, it's only because of the microphone that I'm sitting here. It's a big difference when I teach without a microphone and with a microphone. So give credit to the microphone, and one day I'll bring out of my office the original microphone brought to me by Rabbi Manny Holzer in 1971. V'ani modeh l'Kadosh Baruch Hu, thank God for the microphone. L'aricha German Tovin, to the microphone and to the person sitting behind it. Until we meet again this evening at 8 p.m., we should only have Besorah Tova, Yeshuat, V'nechamat, Aleinu V'al Kol Yisrael, Das V'danya. Welcome. How are you? How is your wife? You look a little older since I saw you last.
It happens the best.
Thank God it happens. Let's put it that way. And Charlie, I told you, I met your son there at the what a community, what a community. Okay, yeah, you can turn it off.
Story about the Rebbe's parents not being there. My oldest son got married in Cleveland in February, and they told us the year before, they also had somebody from New York wanted to marry somebody in Cleveland. The cousin came to Shabbos. His parents were thinking, bright Sunday morning. They got snowed into New York. They heard their son Spooker on the telephone in the telephone booth. If they told us that, we came a week early to Cleveland. Other thing that my father-in-law, Zechut Tzadik Mirbachu, was Mukhabed Reb Schneer Cutler to be Masada Kedushin at our wedding. He comes in and he says, Rav Menachem Mendel Karagin is here. I'm not touching it.
That's exactly. But in the Hasidic world, that wouldn't happen.
And he also, my Zaidi, insisted that a mitzvah tanz was done.
Right.
We have pictures. Someone else wanted to come in.
Wouldn't
he
let
said, him. No, let's make it. I'm a mitzvah tanz with the kallah.
With the kallah. Yomo, today's shiur called the wedding, and next week will be the husband and wife. What? The wedding. What I titled it is for next week. I never reached it.
I will not be able to be in class for the next 2 weeks.
You're in London.
I'm leaving Sunday this Sunday and returning the next Sunday.
I saw the
thank
picture.
You very much.
Have a good trip.
Nice of you to give me
a safe trip.
I'll write to them.
Correspond with them.
And they're very sensitive about that.
Right.
But the emissaries, that's what they feel.
Say the emissaries.
But they say that it's nice what they say. Geshem et Gaya.
It's a nice spot.
They don't say Goyshem et Gaya.
Nice
so that
spot.
Means that he already has the Kedusha.
Right. And I agree with that.
Yeah. Why not? Now that he's Jewish.
It's a great thing what you did. Are you still in touch with the doctor? Is there any?
I go to visit him.
Is there any improvement in his condition?
No. We don't know. 7 weeks, 7 years. So I have a question. What happens with the artificial insemination when the tata, the wife, gets it?
Right.
The father's a Kohen.
Right.
Mipnei darkei sham, can the boy...
That's a terrible shaila, but how can you turn a Kohen into a Kohen if he's not a Kohen?
Yeah, I mean, how you turn a Goy into a Kohen if he's not?
I mean, he's not a Kohen.
No.
Forget he's a Goy, even from another Jew. But it's not a Kohen. The chances are Kohen is a miyut shebemiyut.
So there's no way to keep that as a secret?
No. The Achronim will deal with it. No one has to say. There's no way out.
Unless they can say, instead of artificial, they could say adopted.
Yeah, they can say whatever they want, but AID is better than adopted.
What about having a Kohen?
If a kid is adopted, he wants to find out who his natural parents are, his birth parents, they call them. If it's AID, it's a little less. There's no need to hunt. And AID, I don't even know if you can ever locate who really gave those sperms.
So it's better to get from a goy than it is from a Jew.
That's Reb Moshe's tshuva.
What about a Kohen?
What about a Kohen?
For a family that's a Kohen.
That's what we just asked.
If you can prove it's a Kohen, then you have no problem. But most people, AID, you never know Kohen. All they tell you is it's from a man 6'2" with blue eyes who graduated college or has a PhD. All the medical, Bernie Kabakal told me when he was in medical school, and not from Jewish, but not from. So he said all the medical students supported themselves by ejaculating and giving it for AID. You follow? They would go and they would get paid each time. God, and that's how they supported themselves. Bernie Kabakow's father had a liquor store on the Upper East Side. Dr. Belkin was his customer. That was Bernie's father. He used to boast, I sell liquor to the president of Yeshiva University. That was his boast. And Bernie Kavakow, that maneuver, Winiaz, destroyed two of his six children. Breaks the heart.